Until this week, going to the library when you knew you had late fees was like that scene from Better Off Dead where the paper boy appeared around every corner demanding what he was owed. $2.
$2. $2. $2.
But those days are over. The Kansas City Public Library has just announced that they're getting rid of the whole late fee model. Not only that, but the existing fines on your account have been forgiven, which might just be $2 or something like that to you or to me. But all those small amounts add up, and the library has just canceled $250,000 worth of late fee debt. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And this sounds like a crazy idea, but obviously they think it'll work or they wouldn't be doing it. So let's hear about it. Crosby Kemper III is here with us now. He's the executive director of the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Crosby.
Hi, Gina.
Have you ever seen Better Off Dead?
No, I've never seen Better Off Dead, but it sounds like I ought to.
We'll talk about late fees in that case.
Right. Well, so it's Independence Day at the Kansas City Public Library. Actually, we declared independence on July 1st, on Monday, from all fines with regard to late books. And we did this for one really simple reason. There's a lot of evidence, national evidence, research evidence, and the evidence of our own interactions with our patrons, particularly our kids in the library, that fines are, particularly for low-income people, are a barrier to using the library, to reading.
And explain that a little bit. Is the idea that a fee that occurred sometime in the past is like, that's it, we're never going back to the library again, that kind of thing? Or a fear of accruing fees is keeping them from setting foot in the door?
Yes, both. If you're low income, $2, $5, $10 becomes a real barrier. If you've lost a job recently, if you're working two jobs, if you've got a lot of children, you've checked out a lot of books to read to them over a long weekend, and they all go past due.
And those fees can go over to credit collectors, too.
We have a credit collection agency that jumps in at a certain point, and that's not the best way to deal with your patrons, particularly your young patrons, and the evidence shows that people actually, there's a psychology to this, and if you eliminate fines, people actually tend to return books more often. You know, you get books back that you wouldn't have gotten back.
Prove it to me. the idea that you get books back when you don't have fees in the place. I guess that
it's
you get them back at all.
Because people are afraid to return them because of the fines.
Oh, gotcha.
So you get to a certain point with a book
so
or
they're
fine.
They're just hiding out.
And it may be, particularly again in low-income families, it may be very early in the cycle. You know, it may be over $2 or $10. People say, well, I just can't use the library anymore. If I return it, I have to pay it. I can't pay it, so I'm not going to use the library anymore, and I'm not going to return the book. So it actually turns out to get more books back. That's number one. It encourages much more reading on the part of children, and it doesn't increase. In fact, it may slightly decrease the number of books that are lost forever. People, you know, they're damaged, or people leave town, or the very small handful of people who don't adhere to the values of civilization and returning books.
So walk me through, though, this decision-making process and some of the conversations that I assume had to happen behind the scenes over a long period of time. Like, I would love to be a fly on the wall for some of those conversations.
Okay, sure. Well, library directors of the large urban libraries, and there are about 150 of us, for instance, in the Urban Library Council membership, and we have a listserv conversation that goes on regularly about issues, and one of the issues over the last 3 or 4 years has been going fine free. A number of libraries have done it, most of them in the first couple of years, I would say, were either smaller libraries or suburban libraries, where it was a little bit less of a factor. But larger urban libraries have started to do it. And now about 450 libraries have done it. And there's some research about this. There's the experience of these libraries, and there's some serious research coming out of library schools and economists and whatnot that shows the information that I just gave you, that actually this increases reading. Increases children's reading in particular, and it encourages people to check out more books and to bring them back more often.
It must have been hard, though. I mean, so I imagine you were not just having conversations with your colleagues on this listserv, but that you had to be talking to people, various kinds of stakeholders here in Kansas City.
Well, we talked to the board for sure about it, and we worried about. I wouldn't say we talked about it in detail with other stakeholders. I think the board represented all the stakeholders. We certainly waited till after the vote on the levy. This has a small financial impact on the library, and we didn't want it to become a part of the conversation on people voting on our levy, because it's complicated when we actually explain the economics. We had about $70,000 is currently the number that we have on an annual basis from fines. That's been declining for years for a variety of reasons, the internet streaming books, audiobooks, et cetera, which get automatically returned to
yeah.
us. Our library values and our librarians have been encouraged to look at family situations, circumstances around particularly young people's fines. And so we've been reducing our fines just on an individual basis.
And for a long time, you've had those fine forgiveness days
right.
or weeks or whatever.
We've worked with harvesters. This actually is one of the most difficult decisions we made. Is we've had a period. I forget exactly what the period is, whether it's a week or 2 weeks. I think it's a couple of weeks, where we forgive fines for people bringing in food, canned goods, typically that can be given to harvesters, which can then be re-given to folks in need, and to programs like a program that Harvesters works at the library, where we do programs on weekends and holidays and summer in a number of our branches around activities for kids who frequently come to the library without enough nutrition. So that was we're giving that up, but that was one reason that fines were getting so low. And then we'll save some money on this in terms of equipment and staff time and whatnot.
So explain that.
Well, it takes a fair amount of staff time to process the fines through our system, and we use equipment to check in the books, et cetera, and it'll be less use of that equipment and less use of Unique, which is our service that the credit agency, the collection agency that you mentioned before. So all those things reduce the cost to the library once we go fine free. So the net in terms of the actual cost to the library is pretty low on this. It's a few thousand dollars probably.
When you talk about staff time, that has to be sort of earth-shattering for your staff in that case, that if a significant amount of their time was going to sort of chasing down people for late fees or just even keeping track of late fees, that has been lifted.
Yeah.
I imagine for people who go into library science, they were interested in doing something other than tracking late fees.
Well, absolutely. Our professional librarians, and really everybody who works in the library, is mission-driven, and that mission usually has something to do with reading, something to do with helping the community. And so we're going to increase reading in the community by doing this. We're helping people, particularly we're helping people on the lower end of the economic scale. And that's part of library value. So, yeah, I think librarians are very happy about this.
Over the period of time when you were considering this, working toward it, it must have been very hard not to let it slip, because you can't put a little hint out there that maybe fines will be forgiven and then not do it. So this had to be a very tightly guarded secret.
We did. And we wanted to make a big splash. That's, you know, why we're here today, is we wanted to make a statement in the community about what the library is up to and send a message. You know, after the one of the things that we noticed in the Levy campaign is that people were really interested in the library helping the most challenged people in the community. Whenever we talked about that, reading in poor parts of the community, for instance, we got a bright light shone on the library, and so we knew this was important, and we knew it would get attention. And so, yeah, we did keep it secret, and we did want to spring it on everybody on Independence Day.
What are some of the reactions you've heard so far?
It's all been great. I mean, I've probably received myself alone about 50 emails from various people, including, you know, not just people in this community, saying bravo and well done. And I've not heard a negative word so far.
Not one.
Not one so far. I'm sure they lurk out there. But
the lovers of late fees.
Yeah. Well, there's a taxpayer question about this, and it's why some libraries have a hard time doing it. There's some libraries, including libraries in our community, for whom the fine revenue is actually a significant part of their revenue. And I understand why that's a really tough question for them. For us, it was $70,000 in a $20 million budget. And when we have some savings on the other side and some increase in our mission-driven activities, that's not a hard decision for us.
We've talked about the finances of it, but like philosophically, what's driving this?
Well, the free public library, I mean, just think about that. That is something that's a very important thing in the United States. The Pew does studies of this that show the free public library is one of the most respected and most used institutions, and probably the most universally used institution in the United States. And the free part of that is one major reason. And people seem, you know, we got 84% of the vote when we went out for a tax increase for the library, 84% of the vote. That's extraordinary. And people love the library. They love the free part of it. And they understand the free part of it is more important to people on the other side of the socioeconomic divide.
Well, you mentioned that this is kind of a growing trend in the library world. And I want to hear more about that from Ramiro Salazar, the president of the Public Library Association. He's also the director of the San Antonio Public Library. Hi, Ramiro.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello. You have been pushing to eliminate fines on youth materials in your library system. Is that right?
That is correct. And I would like to commend and congratulate Crosby for implementing this initiative. I think it's great, and I think it's needed.
Hi, Ramiro. Thank you very much for that.
What can you tell me a little bit more about your situation in San Antonio and how it differs and what it is you're pushing to do, what you're having to do to make the case?
Absolutely. And there's a movement throughout the country to really move in this direction. And before I explain our situation, I do want to acknowledge the fact that the American Library Association actually adopted a resolution encouraging libraries of all types to move in the direction of eliminating fines, because we recognize that fines serve as barriers to access. And Crosby explained the rationale. From our perspective in San Antonio, it's all about focusing on equity. And eliminating fines or reducing fines or mitigating the impact of fines is something that we had been discussing for a number of years. About 2 years ago, the city of San Antonio made a commitment that city resources and the budget development process will be driven from an equity lens. In other words, recognizing that it's not enough to say we're providing equal access to resources to the city by having, for example, 50 computers in each library location or having equal collection access. We recognize that not all communities are the same, and there are communities that are disadvantaged socioeconomically. And in the case of fines, it serves as a barrier, as Crosby indicated. $5 to me may not be a lot, but to households that are near the poverty level, under the poverty level, or social economically disadvantaged, that's a lot of money.
Well, and interest does cause those to climb, too.
That's right. So I would like to get back to the point of equity. So if we're really serious, and I believe in equity, because it's not enough, again, as I indicated, saying let's go ahead and provide equally these number, I'm going to use 50 of computers across the city. If a certain community does not have the skills, digital literacy skills, to be able to actually utilize that resource, then it's not going to make a difference how many number of computers we make available.
Or so if they're scared to come in the door because they have late fees.
And that's the other part of those barriers or transportation. I mean, there's so many aspects to equity that it's a serious lens that we need to take, and I'm proud of the city of San Antonio that now we're doing that, and so that gives us an opportunity, the San Antonio Public Library.
Yeah, I'm going to jump back. We'll pick right back up with this conversation. It's about the Kansas City Public Library's decision to get rid of late fees, but also the bigger picture of libraries doing that. I also want you to start thinking about wrong number texts you've received, because we'll be asking for those stories later in the show. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a second. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about library late fees and the unintended barriers they've created when it comes to all people accessing what's inside these spaces that are intended at the very heart of what they do to be for everyone. My guests are Ramiro Salazar of the San Antonio Public Library. He's also the president of the Public Library Association. That's a subset of the American Library Association. Hi again, Ramiro.
Hello.
And Crosby Kemper III is in studio with me. He's the executive director of the Kansas City Public Library, which just announced that it will be abandoning the whole late fee model and forgiving existing debt to the tune of $250,000. Hi again, Crosby.
Hi. And we have abandoned. July 1st was Independence Day at the Kansas City Public Library.
So I do want to get back to this idea of equity that, Ramiro, you were just talking about, because okay, so this is something that I talk about in a lot of library interviews, and I can't help it because I personally just find it so compelling. On the first anniversary of September 11th, a bunch of libraries across the country stayed open all night as sort of a vigil for democracy. The idea behind it was something that until that moment I hadn't consciously thought about before, which is that access to information is a pillar of democracy, and by making information free, the library is fulfilling a patriotic duty. Crosby, can you start us off talking just about that idea?
Well, so we have a Missouri example of what you're talking about in the Ferguson Library, which was the only public institution that was open to everybody during the violence that happened after Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Missouri. And you know, it was a brave thing for them to do and a welcome thing in the community. And it was open to all the community. They had people fleeing the violence. They had people fleeing the police. They had police coming in to arrest. Everybody was welcome at the public library. So that's a huge function. We provided a disaster relief function. You know, when hurricanes happen, when tornadoes happen, the library is a center of first responders, if you will. So the library serves all those functions. But I also like to echo what Ramiro said about equity and computers and relate it to fines. Our largest number of computers and our largest computer use in the Kansas City Public Library system is at our Bluford Library. We put very consciously, very intentionally, we put the largest number of computers. It's the poorest community that we're in. People don't have access to the internet. But just putting the computers there, which is a great benefit in the community, and they're heavily used. But his point about digital literacy, which depends on basic literacy, which depends upon learning to read. And so anything we can do to increase reading in this community increases equity. Anything we can do to increase reading increases equity. It also increases economic development. It's all good. The results of reading are all good.
Ramiro, jump in here.
Sure. Well, obviously, I support what Crosby's saying. But back to the fines and equity. So equity is one aspect from libraries eliminating fines. And we view public libraries as as a free space, as being free and available to all. And we know the power and significance and value of public libraries in building better communities and empowering communities. And if libraries are really to be free, this whole notion of fines, that's a punitive action. That's in its, just by its meaning, it's punitive. And I don't think there should be any negative connotations associated with public libraries that make it harder for those that need libraries to actually utilize our services and resources. And by the very nature, fines, I believe, are punitive and turn off people. And it also, again, as the case was made, it's a barrier to access. So I am pleased that many, many libraries are moving in the direction of either eliminating fines altogether or eliminating fines for certain types of library materials. In our case, we initiated a pilot just a month ago that removes fines for youth and children's materials. We started that as a pilot to gather some data, and we hope that as part of the budget development process for next year that it becomes permanent. And we're also looking at doing a total fine free, but we felt we needed to take that step when we discuss this initiative with the city leadership.
You know, I do want to talk about where you are with your city leadership, because you're having a sort of a little bit more of an uphill climb toward being able to get this through, even in just having to do it incrementally, starting with youth fines. Can you explain why that is?
I think fines is a revenue. It's a revenue source. And initially, the attitude from my perspective was that the library as a city department is responsible for generating X revenue that goes into the general fund. So the attitude before we started applying the equity lens was that if you're going to do something that will eliminate a certain number or amount of revenue, then you need to figure out a way to replace that. In our case, it basically translated to some kind of a service reduction in order to generate a savings to offset that revenue loss. With the equity lens, it's a different view of how we are serving the city. So you can't do both. You can't eliminate a fine that will result in unrealized revenue and yet apply services from an equity perspective if we have to reduce services in some other area.
So I want to jump back in thinking about this whole idea of equity and the idea that there are barriers to accessing the information that exists in the library and the other resources that go beyond information, that there are barriers and that they go beyond late fees, and that you hinted at those things like transportation, things like literacy, barriers that I'm guessing are also on your agenda to work to break down. And I want to talk to both of you about that.
Sure.
Other barriers that are still out there that you've got to, like, if this were an action movie, you'd be like kicking through them.
Well, the ALA's had over the years had different views of how you serve your population and how close a branch needs to be to everybody, for instance, how many branches you should have. In the age of the internet, one would think branches are less important. But in fact, for folks who don't have access to the internet, for folks who don't know how to use the internet, and there are a lot of them, probably 25% of our population fit that description in the Kansas City Public Library. The branches are important, and then outreach is very important, going out into the community and presenting resources, including computers and certainly books, is very important. So we're spending more money on that. We're spending money in getting out into the community. I do want to say one other thing that I think is about equity, and that everybody, whatever their background, whatever race, color, gender, respect. Universal and equal respect for each other is very important. So the biggest barrier we had to going fine free was there are some people who don't respect the fact that the book checked out of a public library is a community resource, is for everybody. And if you don't return it on time, you're potentially preventing somebody else from using that resource. That's actually, I think, the most difficult question is if you abuse the system and don't return books, particularly if you don't ever return the book, it's gone forever, that's a cost to everybody in the community and is showing disrespect for the community and for everybody else in the community. But that's a tiny number of people. But that's something still that we all have to work on.
So like developing some sort of motivation, if it's not coming from respect and it's not coming from fees, is that the question
here? Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that public libraries do is librarians, one of the trainings that librarians get, and I think most librarians are naturally have a natural attitude and aptitude for this, is to show respect for everybody. And we try to respect everybody from the homeless people who show up in the library to the CEOs of corporations who show up in the library, every part of our community showing respect. And we hope that that models for our patrons respect for each other and respect for the library and respect for the community resource that the book or the computer or whatever it is represents.
I'm thinking about the idea of late fees and equity, something that crossed my mind that I had never really stopped to think about before is that act of returning the book, I think of it as an act of respect too, but I can't imagine a life situation where getting back to the library to return it on time, that obstacles could arise in a path that wouldn't be necessarily equal.
Absolutely. We have a very large number of people who walk to the library, not because they enjoy that stroll on a nice summer day, 99 degrees in Kansas City, but because they don't have any other way of getting to the library. So absolutely, there are a lot of barriers that various people in our community experience, and our goal is to get over those barriers, and as Ramiro said, in the most equitable way possible.
Ramiro, tell me about, like, when it comes to these other barriers aside from late fees, what is sort of in the big picture across the nation when it comes to the thinking around how to break those down?
The big picture thinking is to encourage libraries of all type to really look at delivering services, again, from an equity perspective, and to really do an assessment of what are some of those unintended barriers that may exist as part of doing business. And so, again, I'm proud of the city of San Antonio. The city created an office of equity that is helping each city department apply an equity assessment tool to help us identify those unintended barriers, barriers that speak to language barriers. For example, in our community, we not only have individuals that primarily communicate in Spanish, but other languages. We have physical barriers that may provide impact access for those that have physical disabilities. And so this assessment tool is helping city departments, including the library, to better understand some of those barriers that some exist unintentionally. Like, for example, fines. Fines were at one point considered a good idea, that it would encourage folks to return books on time. But studies have shown that really that it has no significant effect in that regard. It has the opposite effect. And I'm encouraged by the preliminary results that I've have knowledge of from libraries that have gone fine-free, that it's actually the opposite. Folks are returning items on time and therefore making it available for others. So I think it's a good thing for libraries, and it really speaks to making our libraries more accessible to all, especially those that need our resources the most, and those are those communities that are so socially, economically disadvantaged. And so I think I'm very pleased that we're moving in that direction, and that's a movement that's getting a lot of traction.
Crosby, the announcement that the Kansas City Public Library has made also includes news that the Kansas City Public Schools plan to follow suit.
So, yeah, we have a very close relationship with the Kansas City public school system, and every child in the Kansas City public school district has got a library card, and we help them run the school libraries. And so we wanted to do this together, and we are doing it together. Mark Bedell has been a big supporter of this.
And superintendent,
Our superintendent. And so they're going fine free with us.
How will that work? What can you tell us about that plan?
Well, as I said, the library system basically, our library system is their library system. We help them do that. So it's essentially turning a switch.
Yeah, I can. You hear so many stories when you hear about the politics around school lunch and sort of shame around carrying fees for lunch or being on the free lunch program. And I can imagine that there are kids out there who have a lifting of a kind of shame.
Right. Well, the kids in the Kansas City School District, of course, about 90% or maybe slightly higher, I'm not sure, but it's around that, are free and reduced lunch. And their identifying number, which you need to get lunch, therefore we all know their identifying number, is also their library card number in the school district. And so that makes a lot of things easier. And we're working on other programs, working closely with the school district to make the library card an access card to the whole community.
Crosby Kemper III with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Gina.
And Ramiro Salazar, thanks for joining us from San Antonio today. Good luck with your efforts.
Thank you.
Up next, a local writer is on the road with his friend to talk about her book, and they've been asking people all over the country for wrong number texting stories. The results are funny, so we want to know yours. Have you gotten a text from a random number? What happened? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm joined by Adib Karam. He's the author of a young adult novel, Darius the Great Is Not Okay. It's gotten lots of attention, including on this show, also lots of awards. And now the author is on tour with a friend for her book. As part of that, he's been playing a fun game on social media that we want to get in on, but I'll let him explain it. Adib, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been soliciting stories on Twitter. Stories about what?
I've been asking people to tell me their funniest wrong number stories, whether it's a text or a phone call, or I've even just got some really like random mistaken identity stories as well, and it's been utterly delightful.
This is all part of the promotion around your friend's new book, a young adult novel called Technically You Started It.
Correct. It's not technically a wrong number story, but it is a story of mistaken identity. It's a romantic comedy told entirely through texts between two teenage nerds in Minnesota/Iowa. It's a little vague, but it's kind of Minnesota to me. And
it's a vague Midwestern place.
It is a vague Midwestern place. And it's delightful. It's written by one of my very first writing friends I made. We got to know each other back in 2014 when we were both baby writers writing very bad books and trying to get them published and wondering why we couldn't. But we learned a lot together. We've kind of marched in lockstep through the stages of publishing together, writing better books, getting agents, selling our books to publishers. And just because of a fluke of calendars, my book came out last year and her book came out last Tuesday. So altogether, it's been a lot of fun. And so I had fun promoting her.
But explain what inspired you to sort of use this core moment of mistaken identity in her book to reach out for these wrong number text stories.
Part of book promotion is often giving away books, getting early copies into hands of readers or reviewers, or we call them bookstagrammers or booktubers, young people who like to promote books through social media. And sometimes it's kind of randomized, and I feel like that can be a little impersonal. And so I thought, hey, this book is all about mistaken identity. Why don't I do a contest where people can send me funny stories, and if they make me laugh... Or actually, Lana got to pick the winners, and I was like, if they make Lana laugh, we'll send them some books.
Okay, so we're going to hear some of the stories that these young adult novelists have collected in just a minute, but we also want your stories at 816-235-2888. Wrong number text stories. We need to hear them because we really need to start laughing to get in the holiday spirit on this July 3rd. 816-235-2888. And I'm going to start with a call from Lisa Rodriguez. the PM newscaster here on KCUR, because she told me a story in the hallway once that cracked me up. Lisa, hello.
Hi, Gina.
Tell your story, please.
Well, so in addition to doing the afternoon newscast, I cover Kansas City, Missouri City Hall. And I find that the best way to contact a lot of city council members is by text. They'll respond to text faster than they answer the phone. And so I think kind of in a confused moment in one afternoon, I was texting who I thought was my boyfriend about the latest menu item at Taco Bell. You know, we get excited about that kind of stuff. And so I texted, I went all out. I texted a picture of the menu item. I texted, "The chicken is the shell," in all caps, and realized very quickly after hitting send that I had texted a member of our city council. I will not disclose his name since he does not know I'm sharing this story. But and so I quickly just scrambled to recover. I was like, "I am so sorry. That was the wrong person." And he just responded, "Cool." So I think I'm just going to be like kind of funny and save myself from this. And I said, "But hey, if you do taste it, please let me know what you think." And I just got like a ha.
So no enthusiasm over the fact that the chicken is the shell.
It was like we're a taco where instead of the crunchy shell, it had like crispy fried chicken as the shell.
Lisa, have you tried this menu item?
I never did. I think I might be scarred from it.
Oh, man. Well, so also like the awkwardness of, you know, when you make any kind of screw up in person, you can look someone in the eye and kind of know it's okay. But instead, you're like, I'm guessing, reading into the minimalist nature of the response, like, uh-oh.
Yes. Yes. And the next time I saw this councilman in person, I tried to be like, "Hey, been to Taco Bell lately?" And I just got blank response. I just really failed on all fronts there.
Well, Lisa, I don't think you failed. I think you have succeeded in providing us with an awesome story.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Anytime.
Bye. So, Adib, what are some of your favorites from the story collecting you've done online?
The one that stuck with me most, and it's hilarious and also a little haunting, is there was someone who submitted a story about when they were 6 years old and they were running late and so for a family trip. And so their mom asked them to call their uncle and let them know they're running late. Turns out they did not call their uncle, but they went on to have like a 10-minute conversation with a stranger. And when they got to the uncle's house, the uncle had no idea they were going to be late. And it was like a horrifying but hilarious, who were you on the phone with, like a familiar family member for 10 minutes?
There's also one that I liked. I've read through them. There's some girl who thinks she's texting her mom, and the recipient is like, "I'm not your mom." But can you imagine if you have sort of a lighthearted relationship with a parent that like there might be a joking like, "I'm not your mom," or something like that. So this is what I guess this person thinks is happening. And so she just kind of won't abandon the belief that this is her mom, no matter what the recipient says to her.
Oh, right. And that's the one where she was basically like giving the girl permission to like go to a dance or something, and like
I think that she got permission to go on a trip.
That's right. That was a good one.
And then she's like, "Hey, so and so, such and such," and the mom's like, "Who's that?" And she's like, "Mom, you're so silly. Like, of course it's this person." And she's like, "I told you, I'm not your mom." It's like,
right,
sort of upsetting how much this person won't believe it.
It is. People can be so funny about technology sometimes. And, I think I've just really enjoyed seeing the stories. And I also got to share my most favorite that ever happened to me is someone sent me a picture of a baby and said, "Look at your beautiful niece." And it was an adorable baby, but I do not have any nieces. And I was like, I've never seen this child before. And I was like, what a beautiful baby. It's not my niece. Who are you? Congratulations anyway.
Let's talk to Nancy calling us from Independence. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What's your story?
Well, my story is similar to the baby story. I want to start with I'm 68 years old, so fishing for compliments is just kind of part of my everyday stuff. And I took a selfie of myself one day and of an outfit, a new outfit. I sent it to my girlfriend in Colorado, and I said, "How adorable is this?" And she didn't answer right away. The next day, I got a text that said, "I'm not your friend, but you do look pretty good."
A compliment from a stranger is even more valuable than
a stranger.
So do you still run your outfits by this stranger, or no, it's a one-time deal?
No, it was just a one-time shop, but that's a good idea. I didn't even think of that.
This stranger seems receptive. I think you should consider it, Nancy.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that
good idea.
Thank you so much for the call. You can call 816-235-2888 with your wrong number text stories. Adib, this does remind me of, Nancy's story does, of one of the other stories that was submitted to you, which was, can I just read this?
Oh, please.
So lady called yelling, "Why was I cheating with her man? Wasn't, different state, walked to the local museum for a selfie to prove it, but kept talking. Told her she deserved better. She told me maybe I was right. Texted me a week later that they broke up."
That's so beautiful. I love it.
I think, you know, when you think about this being in the hands of a novelist, all these stories, the idea that the person on the other end of the line has a decision to make about how much to engage, your imagination really can run wild. And this sounds like fiction. I mean, you couldn't write it any better.
Mm-hmm. It really does. And I think what's fascinating to me is seeing the way that technology is changing us. Because like the story you just described, 20 years ago, that kind of story might have played out in like a bar or something. And now it's happening between complete strangers who've never seen each other face to face, but one is telling the other that they deserve better in their life and making a positive change. And I think that's really kind of remarkable.
What's cool about the wrong number situation, cool or haunting, as in the story mm-hmm. with the 6-year-old, is that people are instigating intimate conversations because they don't know they're talking to a stranger. But that can be a horrifying thing, but it can be a beautiful chance encounter as like a way of just breaking down that whole strangerness.
It really is. There's a sort of alarming and liberating quality about the anonymity that the internet and social media and technology bring to us. Sometimes I think it can bring out the worst in people, but other times it can bring out the best, and it can be almost liberating.
Let's talk to Stacy. Stacy is calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Stacy.
Hi.
What's your story?
Well, my story is just a little bit different, but also a technology connection just technology quirk of fate. I have your producer who spoke with me on the phone called it a name twin, who has the same name that I do, first and last, but the first name is spelled with one letter differently. And she lives with her family in Virginia, and she realized that she had gotten an email that was intended for me because our email accounts are first name, last name at yahoo.com, and figured out who I was through the internet, reached out to me, and this was several years ago. We have become pen pals via email, and she and her family even made a special detour when they were on an RV trip around the country and came through Kansas City, and we all got to meet up.
Do you guys, so there are some people who think that like names can bestow qualities on a person or whatever. Do you feel that the other Stacy is like, do you have things in common that might be name related?
It's funny you say that because I hadn't connected it to the name, but we definitely have a lot in common. We both have, a son and a daughter who are about the same age, and have even joked that, you know, she's kind of the blonde version of me. I'm the dark haired version, but we look similar and have kind of similar personalities. And that's funny. I'll have to think about whether it's connected with the name or not.
Well, Stacy, I like your story, and I'm glad you stayed in touch with the other Stacy.
Me too. Thanks a lot.
It is very romantic comedy-esque.
It really is. I think a lot of romantic comedies stem from like a fundamental misunderstanding that the plot usually draws its tension from, and seeing the kind of unraveling of that and the complications in that is where the fun lies.
Can we talk a little bit about the difference between a mistaken identity text versus mistaken identity phone calls and mistaken identity emails? Are there just sort of like inherently different qualities that these misunderstandings have?
I think more so there's like a bigger difference between phone calls and the other two, because with phone call you can recognize a voice and you'll have sort of a context to it, whereas an entirely text-based medium, whether it's text or email, you don't have that quality that there can be something to recognize. And with emails, it can often be a very polished presentation because you have time to edit your emails. But text, I think you kind of get a glimpse into how people think. And technically, you started it, for instance, the two characters have very different texting styles. One is consistently using capitalization and punctuation, but also has just like some words that she can't spell right for the life of her. And the other one frequently just responds with only punctuation, or omits periods at the end of sentences, doesn't always capitalize. And it's sort of a glimpse into his mindset. And I think it's really fascinating that when you read it, you can start to pick up on how their language reveals their character, even though it's purely text.
You have a little more time to get in on this at 816-235-2888. We're talking to young adult novelist Adeeb Karam about a little project he's been working on to promote a friend's book, a book called Technically You Started It, where he's been collecting stories online about wrong number texts. 816-235-2888. And Adeeb, I do want to talk to you a little bit about just the fact that you are participating in your friend's book launch, because I have noticed that in the social media presence anyway of young adult authors, you seem to all have, you're like on a team together.
We really are. I don't think people start writing for young adults without getting into it because they want to be making a better world for young readers. That's really, I think, why we're in it. It's not an ego-driven thing. That's not like there's a bunch of money in writing books, really. You do it because you want to do it. You do it because you want to make a better world. And so there is a sort of team mentality for the most part. In the last 5 years or so, ever since We Need Diverse Books started, it's an organization promoting equity and inclusiveness in literature. There's been a feeling that a lot of us who have more marginalized identities have space to tell our stories a little more. And so there is a lot of boosting each other, lifting each other up, working together to try to get the word out about books that we like.
Since last time we talked, you have toured with your book, and now you are going on the road with your friend's book. But can you talk to me a little bit about maybe those face-to-face interactions, especially from the standpoint of, as you said, being part of being someone with a marginalized identity, and in your case, more than one?
Right. So as an Iranian-American and as a gay man, I've gotten to talk face-to-face with lots of young readers who have read my book and who have gotten to see themselves represented on the page, sometimes for the first time. Children's literature scholar Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop wrote a very well-known and often cited article talking about how children's books can be windows, mirrors, or sliding glass doors for different experiences. And I think for those of us doing the work, it's really important to be providing those. And so getting to see when you've been a mirror for someone is a really intense and rewarding experience. And I've had some really wonderful interactions with readers, some of which were minors. And so I'm not going to like disclose them on the air, but they were kind of excellent.
You know, this is a dramatic change in tone because we have a really good call with one of these stories that you've been looking for. So we're now going back to funny. Okay,
oh,
everyone. Chris is calling us from Kansas City with a mistaken identity, wrong number, text, phone call, email type thing. His is a phone call in the phone call category, okay?
Perfect.
Chris, good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Tell your story.
Oh, yeah. For the last 5 years, I got a new phone number, and apparently my phone number was the previous number for a mortuary in Maryville, Missouri. So I've been getting calls for like once a month for the last 5 years, people wanting me to change engraved headstones. And sometimes it's widows, and they're really upset. And sometimes I get like 5 minute voicemails, and I don't know if I should call them back or not.
Have you ever called somebody back?
No, but occasionally I just answer the phone, and it's the wrong number. And they're like won't even let me start talking. You know, they just go ahead and tell me their whole story before I can even get a word in. So it's been kind of interesting the last 5 years.
Lessons in what you might be thinking about at some future point and what to consider.
Well, I've kind of thought about having like a tombstone engraving business because I get so many calls.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you for that story. Everyone has a phone number, you know what I mean?
They really do. My phone number actually also used to belong to someone. And so I frequently get people who will just greet me and I'll say hello and they'll just shout, AJ! And I'm like, I'm not AJ. Who's AJ?
You are, in fact, Adib Karam, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Adib is the author of a young adult novel based somewhat on his own life. You can hear more about that in our archives. We did a portrait session with Adib when he first published Darius the Great Is Not Okay. KCUR.org/Central Standard is where you can find it, and he's working on another book now. That's a wrap for today. We'll be off for the 4th tomorrow. Tune in anyway. You will catch a holiday special, and it'll be great. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.